Hello, it's my pleasure to welcome Kevin McFadden and Angie Hogan to Raider House this evening. Can everyone hear me? I'm like a little quiet sometimes. Kevin McFadden is originally from the Cleveland area and holds an MFA in poetry from UVA, where he was a Henry Coins Fellow. He's the author, as Hope said, of Hardscrabble, an inaugural selection from the VQR Poetry Series. His poems have appeared in American Letters and Commentary, Fence, Kenyon Review, Parnassus, Plowshares, Poetry, and other publications. He is the Associate Program Director for the Virginia Festival of the Book. Angie Hogan grew up in Eastern Tennessee and also received her MFA in poetry from UVA, where she was both a Henry Coins and a Jacob Javits Fellow. Her poems have appeared in the Antioch Review, Bellingham Review, Harper Pollitt, New Orleans Review, Notre Dame Review, Plowshares, Third Coast, and the Virginia Quarterly Review, among other journals. She works at the University of Virginia Press. Both Kevin and Angie teach letterpress for the Virginia Arts of the Book Center, and you can see their exhibit on the wall. It's all the work of VABC artists. I have a hard time with it's not an acronym, is it an acronym? Okay, the acronym, VABC artists. And they will be able to talk about that as well a little bit after. Great. And for those who don't know, and I don't know if they want me to reveal this, they're also married to each other. But anyway, so thank you. Yes, they don't like to talk about it. But and so Angie will read first. Please welcome Angie.
Poetry out there. So I was thinking about the theme a lot, and it's actually really interesting to me because writing itself is such a solitary act. But the moment that, you know, we come here and read in public or publish a book or in a magazine or, you know, very literally set the poem in lead type and this little composing stick and feel how much the words weigh, right? I can talk more about the letterpress later. But all of a sudden, the poem becomes subject to an audience. And one thing that influences or informs some of the poems that I'm going to be reading from tonight is actually acting. I'm particularly interested in Stanislavski's method. And if you've heard of method acting, Marlon Brando used it. Lots of people just call it the method, but that's all based on Konstantin Stanislavski's teachings, and he really sought to achieve truth on the stage by, you know, training actors to live the experiences and emotions of a character as if they were his own. So just in thinking about setting poems in the world, I thought it's not entirely unlike an actor who prepares in private and then has to perform in public. So in choosing poems to read tonight, I've picked ones that I thought had, you know, either a really definitive setting, real or imaginary, or that in some way had to do with acting, theater, you know, inhabiting a character or a setting. So I'll try to say a few things about each poem as I go along, just because it's Rider House, so I assume that people are interested in process. But, you know, as Hillary said, we're happy to answer questions later, and, you know, about letterpress, the broadsides, writing, who does my hair. She's great. We'll start start with one called Welcome to My Cabaret. I am that pillow in the couch corner, red-faced and ready to lose its tassels. Those filmy letters from the newspaper still haunting your green-veined hands, that's me. 24 colors of countertop, 3-inch squares strung together on a link chain. I am in your unconscious, pretty little head. Buy a few drinks. Put a buck or two in the band of my rabbitless fedora. A mouse with a butterfinger wrapper rustling through the dark. I am the tricks up my own unbuttoned sleeve. A voice, a one-man show. Stay a while. One more cup of coffee. Welcome. I'm your host. This next poem I chose to read tonight because it has a very specific setting. It's the, eighth grade classroom. I think it's pretty familiar to everybody. The title is Playing with Fire. It took me this long to realize I was in love with the eighth grade witch. She whispered peppermint secrets like how to snap a person's neck simply by severing a stolen thread of hair. You see, I liked the way everything looked dangerous, the way she always wore black, tightly around her woman breasts. She studied fuchsia lipstick, books on voodoo, an intricately folded little letter she sent me explaining things, how hickeys are a form of vampires sucking blood, and laughed out loud when I couldn't put it together again. When the teacher grabbed it, she grabbed it back, flashed her lighter, said, "Watch this burn." I just scratched the inside of my blue desk down to the metal where I could see myself winking back at her. And although I was fascinated with that girl in eighth grade, I did go on to be a good student, which landed me in this terrible thing called Girl State in Tennessee, which is, maybe people are nodding their heads, maybe you thought it was great, I'm sorry. But, I could go there to learn about leadership or whatever, but actually when I got there, it was just to learn about being ladylike or something. I don't know, it was very weird, but anyway, that's part of the inspiration for the poem I'm about to read. Part of it is also that all the women in my family, like my mother and her sister and my grandmother, stand a very specific way when they get their photographs taken. It's this pose that they always do, so you never see a snapshot of them just sort of being normal. It's like, I'm going to describe the way they stand in the poem, so I won't spoil it. But also, there was this hilarious thing that my grandmother told me, among many strange things she said, but one was that if you had good posture, that you should be able to hold a dime between your derriere, yeah. for lack of a better word, which doesn't sound really very comfortable to me, but when dimes appear in the poem, that is what I'm talking about. It's prefaced by an epigraph by Aristotle. One sparrow does not make a summer. The way girls stand in pictures. Arms tight to their sides, best leg wedged forward. One foot forms a neat angle to the arch of the other. Cheeks pinched pink, squeezing dimes beneath their skirts. They look at the camera and do not blink. Their smiles are universal, a strand of pearls. Future beauty queens or secretaries of state, they keep their legs crossed and do not look down at the wide-eyed, armless rabbit that will be gone by dusk, removed by some groundskeeper, or the particular silence pooling in its ear's red boat. So, obviously, after that didn't go very well. I went to college and started reading philosophy. You know, like anyone interested in particular. we're the universals. But this is really a love poem, I guess. But a philosopher does make a cameo appearance, so that's my lead-in. And also, I think that when I wrote this poem, I really was extremely focused on capturing the setting for the emotions that are in the poem, the setting in which those existed. So it's called Hard to Get. Oh, baby, the storm winked its golden lashes, slid in from the west, capped cool through the knee of my wranglers, ripped, not unlike you, or vice versa. What felt like certainty, doors open, textbook Kierkegaard, blank bod of a coffee cup, was. I've tried to say this before, and if there was music when I asked to peel off my wet clothes, singing rain reminds me of you, we both knew the words. These things, you unraveling the tight ropes of my boots, a girl on the gallery wall, her pale disproportionate stare, that circus I didn't go to, your plummy hat, each and every bruised sky. Difficult to understand your character, to figure my speaker out. If I tossed the candlestick at you, I meant, I'm not sorry we became lovers. Undo me again. This next poem is called Meditation on a Phrase from Leibniz, and it's a much more imaginary setting. It really takes off from a phrase, I think, and for my coworkers out there. So I was doing some electronic editing of philosophy text. That's the literal setting where this poem started, and then working on Leibniz, and this phrase just stood out to me for no particular reason. The phrase is just, say no more, no more. But that's where the poem was inspired. So, Meditation on a Phrase from Leibniz. But it's nice out. The water's warm. Say yes. But to say it is to believe it. But to say no more, no more, is not to believe. But to say more avocados, pine nuts, bits of fruit and seeds unexpected we wish we'd gathered for. To say no mayonnaise, no bacon, no sweat, no lobe of fear, wolf in the pines, rogue ape in the parking lot. Say it's Friday, sing it. Say whatever will be, but to say no. To say, yes, I can, it is, I am saying this, yes, right there, oh, to say yes. I will tap dance on the caskets, to say no more, that will one day eat me up. Panorama, espadrille, more words, oil, lavender, ocean, hat, boats, straw, jasmine, barefoot. Poem that takes off from a phrase, I think, and it also sort of shows my interest in acting in film. The poem's after The Lovers on the Bridge, a French film with Juliette Binoche, which is very weird. And one thing, there are a couple of lines that are taken from the movie. One of them is croissant crumbs in the pubes, which I just thought was fascinating. I mean, they you know, here it is, you know, subtitles. And not that American movies aren't risque, but you don't really see that sort of mundane level of risque. It's either, like, some terrible, awful thing, or it's all happy. And I don't know, in French films, you just get these sort of weird, mundane things, like these lovers are eating croissants in bed and cleaning butter on each other. I don't know. It's great. Anyway. So, it's called An American in Paris. And sometimes I just want a postcard. Him to airmail a sad Renoir. I miss buttering your thighs. Something eventful. Le Mistral doesn't pipe without you. There is nothing like the night we didn't speak, couldn't, but let the flick of our fingers, Paris lights illuminating the river, the room. A two-way, two-way. His because I didn't understand what came after. Mine because you are, is all I could think to. Sometimes I want to begin in the middle. And wouldn't he say, you have something, letting the thing be mine? And wouldn't my words be more to him, more croissant crumbs in the pubes? Louis, say, I want to paint the shutters blue with you. The grapes are big as plums this year. Say, I don't love you anymore. I want it plainly. I want it unsigned. Sometimes I want to start in the middle, a sad boudoir, je ne, eyes slurring, flutter, lash. In thinking about settings, let's see. Yeah, this applies to the next two poems. I think I really have a tendency to sort of, maybe it's even a cinematic move, I don't know, but to start in a very specific, very literal scene and then to kind of pan out over a broader emotional scene or subconscious or literal, but I think that happens both in the next two. And this one's called Method of Physical Actions. It has an epigraph by Stanislavski. The elements of the human soul and the particles of a human body are indivisible. Method of Physical Actions. Twisted into shapes of pigeon, the floor morphs to rooftop, stone, and Spanish tile. I perch on grass-green shutters and let my wings float out. Studio window. The tree suggests three things, that redness is a virtue, and that one's own breath can act to distort her vision. The ghosts crossing the highway are neither real nor aberration, but an old prescription trying to make out shadows on the fog. This world is more than newspaper, ink rubbing off to rub off one's hands. It is more than one man's amniotic journey trekking the Himalayas via a cup of tea. Terrain changes with the wind. Some softness, sleepy card tables, a field of bovines closing down. Perhaps images do tell stories after court in the cellar for X years. The tree does not reciprocate or toss her vibrant head. Notes for an ingenue. Reader, beware. I cannot tell you the whole story. I was standing in front of my mirror in a felted blue wool hat, or a purple one. I had nothing on but a man's gray t-shirt and thick boot socks. I was practicing pliés. The eyes follow the hands, which move from front to side to crotch and glide up and out again. In, the shirt said. In for nakedness, nothingness. In for his dime-shaped navel, his neck. 33 crows trample the bluish sky over and over like boots. Signal light glares with its one red eye. I arch against wrung sheets, hair dripping into the skin's hollows. Bloodshot silk rises from the bedroom basket, my robe levitating, crows lifting it, half M's at every stitch. His eyes were bluish, trampled, restless, and reddening. My hat was purple. I called myself Anastasia Binoche. out the window, some houses, a constellation of matchboxes, toy pickup trucks asleep on gravel driveways. What lights left scattered like a few glassy marbles in a black bag of jacks. I chose one matchbox, pulled the bottom out, found two redheads tucked side by side. Put them back, I said to myself in the mirror. Shut the cardboard drawer. A golden end stands for nobody, never, his wing beat neck. This next poem actually is the first poem that I ever printed using letterpress, so I thought I would read it for that reason, and I may as well just go ahead and say that this here is a composing stick, which you hold in your hand and set the type letter by letter, space by space, everything is lead, whether it shows up or not. And so when it gets too full, if you're doing something longer than, you know, 4 or 5 lines, then take it off. It on a little galley tray before you're ready to print, but this is where it starts. So I think it's a really interesting experience to set your own work in lead type. You find out strange things, you know, because the cases that the type is stored in are usually California job case, which is arranged according to the frequency of use of the letters. And so you have big boxes for E's, you know, and A's and vowels, and then things like T's, and, you know, frequently used consonants. And I always find myself digging in, like, the K's for, you know, oh my God, do we have one more K? You know, so it's kind of funny, like, I'm always using these letters that there aren't very many of, but it's kind of an interesting thing to find out about yourself that you're obsessed with. This one's called Insolent Monologue, and it has a setting within the setting. I just want to add that. You'll see. Insolent Monologue. Make me a dress, Dukowski. I am plucking off the buttons of this stiff black frock. Paint me into the set of Parsifal. Wagner is nothing but for you to know where I hide under the night sky. I am rolling them toward you, makeshift marbles, unthreaded beads. Spin it out of straw if you must, just work from the ground up. Imagine slipping beneath the structure, the warm ispa of my legs. Look up. This dress is nothing but a blanket for me to lie on while you finger paint. Put your designs on me, Dukowski. I'm more naked than an autumn alp. I should have said that ispa is a Russian word for mud hut. So the next one is actually the most recent thing that I've printed in letterpress, which is up here at the end. I mean, sort of book page size. Broadside and
tippet torta.
Look for the blind strike, which means no ink, but there's an impression. Up in the right corner. There, he's up there. So I don't guess I learned anything particularly new from setting that, except that I still use letters that other people don't use very often. But I guess I would just mention that after doing letterpress for a while and, you know, being involved with printing several broadsides, that something that it is good to think about, that, you know, I think I've learned from doing it, that's good to think about, is the sort of setting for the broadside. You know, I guess if it's going to be on someone's wall, you know, what kind of poem lends itself to that? So just to sort of speak to the exhibit, I think that's something you think about when printing a poem too, is whether it's the kind of poem that you want to sort of wake up and look at or not. Usually not. It's called Chorus of Geese. I light the candles and ask we sit sip and grade caught fish according to preparation. Do you know what I see over the mountain without trying? Clouds, clouds, and now, with effort, the wine-filled pedestal, patio sprinkled liberally with minnow and seeds. Let's just whisper, but imagine a whole flock stopping. They may not care, you say, for fancy baths, pre-feats. Come closer, though, beneath my boa. See the miles I've flown. And I think this is going to be the last one for the night, and I just chose it because it's Firehouse, and one thing, you know, people who are interested in writing say is, oh, what do you write? And you say poetry, and other people write fiction, and, you know. Unfortunately, no, I'm poor. I don't write fiction, so then they say why sometimes, and I don't have a good answer, so this poem is mine. Why I can't write stories. Exposition. It was you, I knew it. I was wearing tennis shoes. Rising action. The blonde stranger, another Swedish lover. You still haven't lost that libido, I presume. Climax. Turning, I walk faster. Falling action. Undetected, I go for yogurt and a taco. Denim moi. Who cares? I have my own French-Canadian lover anyway. Damn, I hate these tennis shoes.
We came to printing in the style that is up there, Angie and I, through my work, really. I knew that there was this great trove of materials to make the kind of work you're seeing up there. And I knew there were really talented artists in town who were willing to teach people, so I passed that information on to Angie. Like a lot of things she gets in and does it very well and takes to it quickly. And then she trained me. So I was very grateful to her for kind of showing me what this stuff was. What we didn't know was years after we'd gotten into it was that this particular composing stick, it belongs to her grandfather, who was a printer of this style. He had his own press in his house. But a lot of them kind of, you know, after age sets in, people can't use them anymore. They just kind of get tucked away in someone's garage. Not used. A lot of people think that means it's a dying art. It's not at all. A lot of people are hot to have these presses and this sort of material because it achieves effects in paper and ink that you can't get, quite frankly, with a printer that we have now. A flyer for something that you want to get out very quickly, of course you're going to use that technology. But for something like a piece of art, you're going to look for something that can give a really nice, use nicer paper that you can definitely put in to a printer. I have a funny little story. We printed our wedding invitations together, which is, we did in lieu of marriage counseling, we decided a group project like that would be, it's either going to work or it's not after we did that.
I was almost putting it in.
Well, we took some of the nice paper and at one point we got tired, so we get, you know, it's directions. Can't we just feed the directions through an inkjet printer and be done with it, which we agreed we would do, we kind of match the style. So we gave those out to people who were to find us. It was a kind of destination wedding in Appomattox, Virginia. And, the people who were driving with these directions, the inkjet was wiping off of the pages they went, which this ink wouldn't do, but it made it kind of hard to find us by the end. Where your thumbprint was the end of the story or the beginning. So this is one of the things we printed first, actually, very much. Angie showing me what was going on. It was a George Garrett broadside for the Virginia Festival of the Book. about 4 years ago, and we really enjoyed it. Johanna Drucker actually sort of funded us for that. She showed Angie how to do the work and said, I'll buy the paper if you guys do it. And we sort of learned what we were getting into, but we also learned that we liked it. A lot of the other broadsides you see are either ones we participated in by sort of arranging them or finding the writers through the book festival, finding the artists, many of whom are in this room. For everyone who has a broadside out there, who is out there, just let's see who you are. Just stand up or raise your hand or a little above. Come on, I know you have something out there. There they are. And you can introduce yourselves and say hi. I won't embarrass you right now because I need to do that. But if you want to ask them which one was theirs, I'm sure they would love to show you and tell you what the part they had in it. Some of them are poems from contests that we've run, winning poems that got changed into a broadside. Some of them are ones we had done for an event. Some of them were that nice one with the carrot and the rabbit right there was auctioned off at the VABC auction last fall. So all of them have a different story, and you know, I'd be happy to tell you what I know of them. They go on to have their own stories beyond their creation. They're just really beautiful to look at. Broadsides originally were anything. I mean, maybe think of your cart sort mail, the stuff you get, flyers. If you had to get information out about an event, government policy, something you were selling, it was a broadside. You know, it could be tacked up on the wall, or sometimes they were unfolded, tacked up. So people see big notices. You see the Declaration of Independence, the one that many people know, is a broadside. It's printed. There's actually a little image of it on this little explanation of what a broadside was. And of course, technology changes the way we interact with these things. Now that you can print, offset printing, it's a different style. It doesn't punch into the paper, it sprays it on. Now that that's so much easier and everyone has one in their home, that changes the need to do it this way, which sort of made it say, well, what are the good qualities of this type of printing? You know, setting it so carefully and getting that impression in the paper. Those are the things that make the art what it is. So we've enjoyed knowing everybody who's added art to these or written them themselves, and you know, we'll answer questions on that line too by the time it's all over. As far as setting poems, the type of setting, I'd echo the things that Andrew was saying, kind of learn a different thing about it. I learned also when I was writing for a book, or to read from a book, I guess, and I sort of imagined that the page, as I was setting it up, was both for the reader to enjoy and get the information off the page, but also to help me read it aloud. Like the breaks on it might correspond to things I would take a breath at, or I want a little bit of extra pause on that word. So that's how I would set it up. Translating it into broadside, sometimes we stick with that. We stick with the author's textual idea of the poem. But it encouraged me to also think about different ways to loosen it up. And in this particular one, I completely loosened it up. That's the title there is, you can probably read it from where you're sitting, but I'll read the poem aloud. I fleshed it right up on that straight line of the eye, because the letters in that particular poem, I think, function in the understanding of it. Is written this way to almost resemble us, half straight, half sinuous. So it is kind of good to have a little flashcard for that one. And I would say there's no one place, I think Angie showed that her poems are set. I mean, they can go anywhere. But even the way that you do poem by poem, sometimes I begin on that tight shot. Sometimes I begin, with a big establishing shot, something large and move to the small. A lot of mine, they're set more in language, which seems redundant. Of course, all poems are set in language. But in linguistic kind of understanding of language and what the words come from or how they sound, what they look like in the case of that poem. So if it starts in any one of those places, it might go to another one. I'd suggest that to preface the ones I'm going to read. There, where words start to enter the poem, little ghosts of this linguistic life that they have kind of emerge. read one called At Rushmore. A man crouches low to fool history for a distance, camera adjusting for his special shot, a wife's smiling head eclipsing Roosevelt, the strange resulting administration. Surrounding dockers get the picture, and one sham past is snapped after another, after another. And this young son of the country, he's got ice cream on his mind. His parents stare up, but he's more enthralled with what may slip any minute, rocky road, an industrious tongue. And what's on everyone else's? The syllables rush and more have brought us this far, true tourists, some most foreign in our own country. Seeing comes first, brochures next, the legendary boasts of need to know that the peak was named for a title inspector, that its sculptor believed in big, that granite set a precedent, intrusion. Wherever from, the unforeseen quirks of production intrigue, having to change the plan to match the mountain's emerging vision, moving the visage of Jefferson to Washington's other shoulder, his second face, the one in place today. Or striking the ominous vein of lead which penetrates Lincoln's head. In these, the mountain seems to have known, carved its people even. Near the base, rubble remains, a talus of blasted stones, dropped names, the part of the image we may come closest to. We happened to be on the road this last weekend, back to Cleveland where I grew up, was born and grew up. And I'm from a dinky little suburb that the Clevelanders I knew and grew up with made fun of routinely. Luck, Brunswick. Ah, for the suburbs kids can play in streets. I was two when we moved. Farms nearby, some charm. My family went for meaningless quirks, so it probably didn't hurt that the police chief then was a man named Crook. Fire chief? Burns. Can't make that up. In school we read that the settlers drew the name from a hat. Brunswick turned up by democratic dumb luck. Maybe that's where its share ran out. Today all malls, or developments where forests stood, if they could chop a tree off the city seal, someone would. My friends I teased about the leave in Cleveland. They teased back Brunswick's run. Home not, as the saying goes, a place to hang your hat. Home where the hat, by name, by chance, hangs you. I did go to school closer in Cleveland, and it's one of those ways that landscape and words do actually interact a lot. The signs that you see, and I have this 30-minute from suburb to Cleveland commute every day that I would take. So I mentioned in it Cleveland, and think of the word of Cleveland, and originally the founder had an extra A that Cleveland doesn't have in it. And I mentioned the composing stick, so Angie showed that properly. That's what comes in there. That story about Cleveland's name changing is true. Omission, Cleveland. When did I notice you begin at sea level? All those years I drove into you, the letters must have slipped me some sooth, though I know you rise above it. Still, sea level fits. The even keel, average, but no slacker, with so little need for an A that you dropped one early on from your composing sticks. Moses's Cleveland squeezed in the interest of space. And somewhere in one of your synagogues, a Kabbalist knows how much can hang on one letter. One omission from the Talmud will end creation, boil the seas, set every river on fire. Your warning or confession, I never could finish. Sea level and what? Open question. This is a poem I'm going to read where I think it starts more in language and then the scene gets set about halfway through the poem. This is named after a Virginia place, Lignum, and then firewood and means, I guess, firewood and Latin. Campfire, Lignum. The world shone in letters, Lucretius believed. In firewood, lignis, was hidden ignis, fire. Whatever kindles your tinder. His mater flirted with matter, for that matter. Linguistics, logistics, two sticks perhaps one shouldn't rub together. But if, on a night like this, by firelight and stars, one hears the pater in the local patter, whose pattern would that be? Father time, mother tongue, we will be true to you in our fashion. Our fashion is to read what we choose to read. The possible good in the bonfire, not the bone. Faint flag in the conflagration, not the blaze. All things are fire. Flames said to have tongues, our dignity and ignorance, our signatures. Next one I'm going to read was actually from our honeymoon, which for me was very close. We stayed around Warm Springs. National news was terrible. We were invading Iraq at the time. You know, I saw the newspaper kind of hit outside our door in the morning. I saw the troops and the invasion taking place. I was remembering my parents' honeymoon was actually during Vietnam when it was escalating. So it struck me with a sort of dark note. It didn't spoil the time. The way I first wrote this poem, it did spoil the time. And it's like, we have a little better time tonight. Better ease up on that. So I tried. The word Fahrenheit, it comes in the last line. In German, it's the name of the person who invented the scale, but that word does mean experience. Honeymoon, Warm Springs. Late fall, a century not yet into its teens, we have slipped one honeymoon afternoon into the thermomother. Water meets our body heat, unaware of its degrees. Only we have degrees. We study anthropometry, tree, limb, foot, hill, the hand of God near enough, whether or not he will show it. Our day's new rings we corrode in this stew. They stay in our pockets in the changing room. We love. We hate what's afoot, what's at hand, a base 10 ban, commandments, percentages, centuries. America, too, has made its vows. It won't give up an inch. It don't have to. The world in arms, our trip's last leg. We recall among the imperial conversions, Fahrenheit is submerged experience. I think I am just going to read one more. And if you do have questions, we'll both pop up here and knock them down if we can. Ready. The last poem I'm going to read is called Fact. It does have as a setting, or certainly invokes as a setting, something I grew up around in the Midwest quite a bit. We had our share of factories in Ohio, auto factories and steel mills. Most of them were closing by the time I was growing up. Some were very much still booming. Booming out pollutants as we went. There was this thing called, I remember growing up, the thermal inversion. I think it still can happen where, because of the weather, the pollution gets kind of trapped below the clouds. Was that maybe what was happening in Beijing? I don't know. But it creates very much that effect that we were seeing, you know, that haze, and it's very bad to breathe. it was limiting the thought, even thinking there's lifespans. This sort of area was not particularly good for quality of air. So that comes into it in the factory sense. Also, some etymologies or maybe words that there's a number of words in here that are close to fact, kind of in the family of its Latin root, which is to make or do. Factum is a thing that has been done or has been made. So that's where the word pulls out. Interesting, because when we think of fact, it is pretty much said and done already, but anything that's made has a maker, which is good to remember. I think that's all we need to do to start. Fact. Call it a plant, but it doesn't bloom. May boom, may bust. It certainly billows. It surrounds us on days of thermal inversion, broad as breath. Whatever it is they make over there lowers the reek we raise a stink about. Noisome, recall, has nothing to do with noise. Some words are planted altogether too close to others. For instance, olfactory, which should bring noses and bouquets to mind, but instead conjures smokestacks, massive machines, bosses, losses, layoffs, picket lines, barred windows, and complaints about the water. Olfactory, olfactory, some odors don't wash off. The dust of industry, the prod of production. It's mistaken identity, and facts may prove it. The relations be poor, but to most ears, Mac, etymology, as bugs. Perhaps it's our strained relationship to fact, hard not to spot in all its forms, facility and faction, facsimile and manufacture, office also, modeled on a Latin make. Still, we mustn't forget, in truth's pursuit, that fact should be more than found or checked. They must be produced. They don't grow on trees. They must be, as they once were, made. I mean a clean, burning assembly line of fact. A lemon designed in the Middle East, squeeze-tested in France, now pieced together by unions in Newark. What could make such a passage intact? Who's weighing freight, handling returns, trucks? Once were wheels. Unchecked, they become the carts. The thumb is drawn to scale. The trick becomes the trade, in fact, in language. All branches, no corporate. In truth, tongues wag, there is no truth, only cognates. And with cognac, higher-ups are toasting that. Lower-downs with whiskey. Doers for the makers. Makers for the doers. As some poor slob caffeines awake at the switch. Which is it, after all? The manufacturer's glitch? Or the faculty of memory? Which one do we call a recall? Let's get down to brass tacks, like management suggests. Back to basics, down to business. But no, we strike for truth, we makers of the world. While a fact may be called a fact, a spade, and we hope, if some maker is for meeting, the facts are recalled. Mistakes were made.
Each other? Do you avoid each other at certain times? Or How does that work?
That'd be it.
Pretty different writers, which haven't been a few years together. We do share our work with each other. We talk about it, but I guess it's at a relatively late. It's either at a really early stage where we're just talking about ideas, you know, trying to get each other to write or be able to get into the right place, or really late on, I guess, which is what we call the warm cookie phenomenon.
it's right there.
Yeah. So, you know, and the rule is kind of just, I've got a warm cookie, I'm really happy about it, just eat it and, like, don't say anything. Just be thankful, you know, and then maybe we talk about it later. But I mean, when we met, we were both writers, so we've always known each other as writers, but I guess we're married first and caused problems in the marriage.
Although you wrote during your honeymoon,
I wasn't writing during.
Was that later?
Okay, after, and thinking back and things like that.
Good.
Like, I find your comments helpful. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are times where we just, like I was saying with the poem, even I think it improved it just to hear it say, yeah, well, there's more to it. I think you know that.
And I think it's also fair to say that we're not each other's best readers in a way, too. Like we.
But we're, I mean, I would say I get great stuff when I hand it over to Angie and say, what do you think of this? And I hear places where she, you know, just like a workshop, you know, you're getting a sort of read that you, it's not your head voice talking to you, and you need that to sort of see how it's going to play for other people on a page, or whether something that you think is working doesn't translate. So I think, you know, both of us, we saw each other as sufficiently different in writing styles. I think if we were closer, that would be hard.
Yeah, because, I mean, we don't feel competitive at all. Like, I don't feel like if someone, you know, takes his poems and rejects mine, that it's necessarily because they think, you know, I'm bad, or it's just they're different. They're so different that we don't feel that we have to compare them, I guess. We just sort of admire from afar. I do anyway. I'm not my V8. I don't think so, but...
But I think there's good sort of DNA trait going on where Angie's definitely, I think, imagistically, just that's where they start for her, and she's got the ability to set that scene very quickly, and because a lot of mine start with words, I have to find that place where it's going to tie in and fit the world, but that she just gets really quickly. So, you know, I think we taught each other.
And like the sort of smart, you know, things that really hit home in his poems, that would just never occur to me. I mean, I wouldn't look at a word and it just wouldn't. I like to hear it, but I would never come up with it. It's just not how my mind works. So it is really nice, though, because we both were dating people who were in law school before we started. And, like, at least the person that I was dating just didn't understand, like, that the process, you know, is solitary, and that, like, I was doing this thing and that it was important and that I didn't want to be interrupted, you know. Sometimes you're moody or whatever, and it helps to just get, you know, to understand that the other person does not want you to come into the room, and it's not personal, you know, and I think it helps to have it in common,
yeah.
Just as far as, you know, if someone's not interfering with you, or there's not kind of a distance.
In other relationships, people would, you know, sort of question me, why are you going off? What did I do? You know, and you really know at your heart, if you're writing, it's not the other person. It's something you have to settle with yourself, that you go off and do. And it's very nice just when somebody, support for that. What can be better than somebody who does it themselves, so they know, you know, they get it, yeah. So, I mean, I'd say that helps for a writer to have someone who either gets it or does it themselves and knows it's not some sort of, say again? Right.
Have you ever been setting, do you both set your own poems in letterpress? Or do you
You said you had.
I definitely do.
Have you used lead?
Have I used lead?
See, he likes to use polymer.
Well, I'm just wondering, have you ever been working along and you decide to make a change to the poem because you see what it's going to look like or how it feels? Or
I haven't yet, but I mean, I make a lot of changes along the way, so.
I know artists who do, who really do.
You could see how the poem would affect how you would lay it out, but it's how you lay it out also.
I think once I have, for me, once I have, this is, I think, the same for you, once you have that way of reading it set, that's going to be, that's going to be the words, you know, not even to drop a syllable. She would kill me if I said, well, do you need this syllable? Yes, I need that. So we kind of put up bars around it there, but then we see what can be moved around with it, or at least I did in that particular poem, what could be moved around.
I agree. You might change it visually, like, I have an poem that I guess that's what you did, but just decided to, you know, write justify it, and it had been always been left justified, and it had a very different feel, actually, just on the paper that way, all of a sudden, I don't know, it changed the reading of it, I think.
That poem right there, and I'll turn it so people up there can see. This is done by Karen Kevorkian. This is a free verse poem, so I think, you know, if you would see on the page, and as she had composed it, it had that sort of ragged right margin where things were. But she kind of put a challenge on herself to say, what if I take all the short lines and choose a bigger font and fill them out to the edge and choose the long lines and keep them kind of at their size or shrink them a little bit and just see what effect it would have. She was gambling completely. And, she did it and it worked. It looks really good. The poem was very attractive. And
gives those lines more significance.
Yeah,
they stand out in a different way. So I think she achieved something in it. And that's part of the fun of it. I mean, we try things out. We see how they work. I think, Andrew was saying, I work in Polymer too, because there's computer programs you can use to get plates made. And there are times when that is what we do. And there are times when this one is in lead. The one out there that Frank Creature did the art for with the horses there, Charles Wright and Charles Simic. That we set with computer and polymer, but the images were drawn and scanned. So, I mean, these things have a synthesis now.
I should say what polymer is.
Yeah. It's still letterpress. Polymer is letterpress printing, but unlike lead, where you set each letter, you know, each word letter by letter, space by space, you can graphically design something and then have a polymer plate made, and so it's... It comes out, it's got adhesive on the back, and at the shop we have like big metal bases that make the polymer adhesive be tight, so then you can letterpress print with that. You have more design freedom that way, and you can choose many more fonts because we only have what's been donated to us.
Yeah, when you're dealing with lead, it's a very physical world. As some people took the broadside class found out sometimes, you have what you have. I mean, it's a block or it's a piece of metal type, and you can't tweak it like we're so used to. I mean, we just think visually, oh, I can extend this letter, I can do this because computer programs make it so fast. Every single font has its own different drawer that is a Roman versus italic, bold and italic, just bold. Every one of those, and in every point size, is a separate drawer that takes up about maybe 2 inches tall by, you know, 3 feet across and at least a foot deep, a little more. So every one of those is a physical thing. So even to have a good range of fonts, you need a lot of space, which is a lot of times why sort of they're going underground and, you know, they emerge somewhere. Or you might see some of the type cases, people put thimbles and spoons in them now, or when you see them in garage sales. Those cases used to hold lead letters, so be careful touching them.
Yeah, don't throw your silverware in.
But, you know, the physicality of that type of printing is a challenge, and that's why I think it still has more prestige than polymer.
I don't know if it has more prestige. It's just a little harder work.
Because then you have to put it all away, too.
I would just say that if one of these really calls to you and you have to have it, I either know the artist that created it or it's a VABC print and we could get one to you. So Feel free to inquire. I'll let you know about them. Whether they're available. Some are not, unfortunately. They're just too few, or they've already been sold. But if there are any of those that you're interested in, I recommend reading them at the very least. Have a glance through and see if you like them.
Feel the back.
Yeah. Yeah, to feel the back. That's what's nice about this. It's pretty interactive.
And where can people get information about VABC?
They can kind of, I have a couple cards, or there's, I think, something on that.
Website. Yeah.
Yeah. Good.
Website.
I give some
Google Arts, too. Virginia Arts and Book Center.
Were you
going to
ask someone?
Yeah. Questions about organizing poems into a book.
Maybe.
Well, I've had this recent experience, so I will. Another time when I needed Angie desperately to find the three typos that were still lurking at a very late stage in it, or more.
UVA Press colleagues, I found typos.
You know, in thinking through the book, I was very long. Essay in it, and it's prose. It's in prose kind of style, and I thought it was rendering the thing unpublishable for a long time because you know you don't want to open a book of poems and see yes to a random page, or at least you don't think you do. I hope you do if you want to read it. But I really felt like that for me was something that would help for what my type of writing is, how to understand it and where it comes from and why I do it and some of the things in my mind going back behind it. And also I felt some of the things that were letting, you know, a poem should be close to song. I mean, a lot of times you don't think of it as that. You don't sing them when we do them. But something that sings at least in the way it's read or the way the language works. So I was getting out of a lot of prose elements by being able to sort of put them in prose, say that stuff there, and let the poems hopefully sing it the way they do it. Because prose can creep in and it can weigh down poems sometimes. And, you know, I think this century, more than the others, has learned a lot from prose and verse, free verse. So, I very much like those advancements. I think they've made the lines more interesting. But you also have to find a way to not just turn it into prose, or why wouldn't you just have chosen prose in the first place? So, for me, just being able to put that in the middle and do some poems before, and that helped me choose how my book would be fit out. And there are two sections in it that are sort of, they look a little the same because they're 14-liners, 2014-line poems. Some set in Ohio, some set in Virginia, and I said, well, the middle is this, and one's on this side, and one's on this side, and then just kind of the rest filling around it. So.
Yeah, I won't talk long because people are probably getting tired, but it did, your speaking just made me think, and I am working on putting together a collection, but a few years ago, I was at AWP, and NEA and the Academy of American Poets or something, they had gotten together and done this study, and actually found that the currency was the single poem. So that if they sort of called up, you know, a random sampling of people, and no one really knew, you know, of Frost's books or something, but everyone sort of knew, you know, two rows by verse and a wood, and so that it's really not the book that, in the long, you know, tale of poetry, that is the currency, but the individual poem. And I think I work very much like that, so it's a little hard for me. I mean, I am working on something. I had a thesis, and now I've gotten some of those poems, and I'm working on new ones, but I do feel like there are a few holes in it to quite fill it out as a manuscript, and I think it's hard. I mean, I think it's a lot of the expectation now in publishing poetry is that this sort of sequential poems and these things, whereas, you know, historically it would just be a collection of poems and they weren't necessarily related. It was just each poem stood on its own. So I think I work more in that way, so it's a little difficult, but
hope I haven't. But I think it's a challenge for everyone. But a good challenge.
Thank you all. You've been very
wonderful.
Thank you guys.